Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the beautiful studio, Studio 4, the Big Dumb Fun Show, right here in Midtown Kansas City in the classic old Ice House building. I'm here tonight with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. There's a lot of different titles for folks in the police department. Oh. Like there's a lot of titles for folks if you're in the mob.
Yeah.
Like an associate or
an associate, a
peckerwood. And if you're a police officer and you ride a motorcycle,
you're a wheelman.
I've never heard that before. Well, but if you're a mobster, who's the guy that drives the car?
Wheelman.
He's the wheelman. You know a wheelman, but he's a motorcycle officer who does work on your motorcycle.
Right. He teaches people how to ride. He's retired now, and he teaches people up at Fort Leavenworth. He's got a contract with the government to teach soldiers safety on a motorcycle and how to ride a motorcycle and get them past their motorcycle qualifications on their test. And he works on motorcycles. He works on mine. And he only uses K&N parts. He's put on several K&N oil filters, and he's getting ready to put on a K&N air filter.
Well, you've got a 1,000cc Kawasaki.
Yeah, and it's fast. Let's see. I haven't reported yet how fast I got up to. It was just a little over 135. I think it was 137. The wind was going by me so fast, it was hard to focus on that speedometer, and it was starting to get a little bit dark, and it's got one of those LED
displays
on your speedometer. And it's a little bit, I don't know, it's kind of gray for the speed part of it.
Well, you know, K&N filters have a million-mile limited warranty, and when you're going 138 miles an hour, you're going to get to that million miles a little quicker.
Yes, you are.
The good news is they last up to 50,000 miles between servicings. These are air and oil filters that are original performance filters for NASCAR.
You say that, I think, but this is we're going to tell about Angelo Leonardo, or Big Ange, as he was always known. He is a Cleveland mob guy. Now, I'm going to Cleveland. We've been to Milwaukee once, and we've been to Chicago several times, and Kansas City, of course, because that's where we come from. Now we're going to Cleveland, talk about the Cleveland mob a little bit. The Cleveland mob was the fourth mob of the cabal, as Bill Owsley, our good friend, retired FBI agent Bill Owsley, called this, a cabal of mafia families who conspired to skim money from Las Vegas casinos. There was the Milwaukee mob, which we've done a story on, the Milwaukee leg breaker, the Milwaukee mob a little bit. We'll do some more. There's a new Facebook page out called the Milwaukee mob, by the way. You might take a look at that.
And a Twitter page as well.
And they have a Twitter too.
Which is just Milwaukee mob.
Yes. Was it at Milwaukee mob?
At Milwaukee mob.
I talked to that guy up there who was interested in stuff, and he was one of our fans, and he was so interested, I said, well, why don't you just start a Milwaukee Mob Facebook page? There isn't one. So he started one immediately, and he's been posting stuff on it, and I'm an administrator on it. I've been posting on a little bit on it, too.
So now we just need somebody in Cleveland.
Right.
With
that's
a Cleveland Mob Facebook page. And
that's
a,
next.
At Cleveland Mob.
Right. So we're going to Cleveland. We've been to Chicago, Kansas City, Milwaukee. The fourth mob family was a Cleveland mob. And we're going to talk about Angelo Leonardo, or Big Ange, because he at one time was the highest ranking mafia member. He was actually the boss of the Cleveland mob when he broke the code of Omerta and became a government witness. As a matter of fact, he testified about how the skim worked and how the four mob families had conspired together and who they used in the Teamsters Union. and gave them all up. He even gave up his own brother-in-law. But let me tell you a little bit about Angelo Leonardo and his reputation. Before that, everybody was shocked. I'm telling you, shocked that he turned government witness. For example, in the 1980s, the FBI recorded a Cleveland mob underboss named Joey Gallo, not the Joey Gallo from New York, the crazy Joey Gallo that got killed. This is another Joey Gallo. And he's quoted as saying, Angelo Leonardo was probably one of the most respected guys in the whole United States. He's really the kind of guy we needed in this town a long time ago. But, you know, nobody ever listened to him because he don't express himself. But out of everybody that's left, this guy commands a lot of respect. I respect him not only because I have to, but because I'm telling you, he's a great guy. Even the police detectives in the Cleveland Intelligence Unit and FBI agents had a certain respect for Angelo Leonardo. One policeman commented to me, he's almost like the Godfather out of the movie version of the Godfather. He was always a gentleman, not a tough street rat. He was someone who recognized us as people in the same general line of work on an opposing team, if you will. And just like Kansas City underboss Tuffy DeLuna, Leonardo maintained respect for the police. When detectives arrived at his home one time to execute a search warrant, Leonardo and his wife treated them like guests and even invited them to sit and have coffee. And the same thing happened to me at Tuffy's house. When we served a search warrant at the end of the SCIM investigation. It's on Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day night, it was a dark and stormy night that night. It was so foggy we couldn't even see but about 3 feet in front of our car. We barely creeped up to his house. We went in and we started searching. They separated out and started searching, and Tuffy turned to his wife and he said, Sandra, he said, make some coffee for these guys. So we had coffee, and she didn't make us any cookies. She was not really happy with us, but Tuffy didn't mind, and he was a gentleman throughout the whole night.
Maybe he didn't think you were going to find anything.
No, he knew we were going to.
And then
find
once you
something.
Did find something, he knew best just to shut up.
Tuffy was cool. Tuffy was cool. Even when they found, he told Jay Airy, Agent Airy, one of the agent in charge of that house. He said, you might as well come on down here to the basement. That's where the good stuff is. And that was his office. And that's where he had a complete set of handwritten records of all his trip to Las Vegas, how much money he spent, who he talked to when he went to Chicago, talking to the Chicago boss. All they had to do was break the code, and it was easy enough to break. But anyhow, I digress. We're going off on Tuffy DeLuna. We want to talk about Angelo Leonardo. Now, Tuffy never broke. He spent his time in jail and came out an old man, died a few years later. In 1982, Angelo Leonardo had graduated to become the boss of the Cleveland mob. But he had this Joey Gallo and some other guys under him were running a big-time cocaine and other drug-selling operation. The strike force prosecutor, as she was prosecuting this, Donna Congini, said she was so impressed with Leonardo's demeanor in the courtroom, she stated he was the epitome of class. Because of his years of careful training in the art of secrecy and insulation, with meetings held in back rooms and decisions made with nods and coded phrases, our case against Angelo Leonardo was difficult to prove. But once a drug ring leader, confidential informant, and mob associate member Carmen Zagaria testified about Leonardo and his methods, the jury could see his power and control. And actually, they could see it in that tape of Joey Gallo talking about this guy. Joey Gallo was no doubt involved with this drug ring. And he commented, he said, he's got a lot of respect. I respect him not only because I have to. I'm telling you, he's a great guy. And that was part of the nails in Mr. Leonardo's coffin that made a jury believe that he was in control of this drug
of this drug ring there in Cleveland.
And they got you in modern times, and by this time in the middle 80s, you got huge draconian sentences for dealing in large amounts of cocaine, which they were doing. As a result of the sentences handed down by the U.S. District Court, Angelo Leonardo, Joey Gallo, and several others would be destined to a life behind bars. And Leonardo was in his middle 70s by this point in time, so it didn't take but about 20 years or even 10 years, and it was life. It was a life sentence. Now, but for decades, Big Ange, or Angelo Leonardo, had survived all the hazardous pitfalls of mafia involvement, bullets in prison, contract killings and vendettas, and gone to prison a little bit himself in the past. He had killed a guy when he was young. We'll talk about that in a minute. And all this time, for 50 years, since he was 20-some, of acquiring power and money as a member of the Cleveland mob, he had spent only 18 months incarcerated. Now, he's in jail. He's in this federal penitentiary in Lewisburg on this narcotics conviction, Aaron. In 1983, the FBI agents, they do this all the time. They will continually go visit somebody like this. And the guys kind of like it, lots of them. They, you know, gives them somebody else to talk to that's not in prison. And they'll visit them and just kind of shoot the breeze with them and kind of offer them, you know, hey, you know, we can help you out here. They say, yeah, I know you can, but I'm not ready. But in August of 1983, Angelo Leonardo broke. They had come there several times. They even transported him down to Kansas City. We were having the skim trials in Kansas City at that point in time. They brought him down here to testify before the U.S. grand jury about Cleveland's participation in skimming from Las Vegas casinos. Leonardo, at that point in time, refused to even address the questions, took the Fifth Amendment. He was offered immunity. And they even gave him a judicial order. Of course, they give you a judicial order, and then you still and grant you immunity, and you still won't testify. They can put you in jail. But he was already basically in jail for life, so that didn't matter.
He was hoping, if anything, that maybe by testifying, if he did, that they would reduce his sentence and he'd get out.
If he would, but at that point in time, he stuck by the code of Omerta. Even though they offered immunity, they had talked to him several times. They just kept coming back. They'd leave their card. But, you know, after they took him back, he must have gotten outside the prison for a little bit, and he got back in his lonely one-person cell at Lewisburg Prison, and he must have weighed his options. He had filed his first appeal on his narcotic conviction case, and it had been denied. Once he got that back, he picked up the FBI agent's card, which he had left, looked at the phone number and the name on it. He quietly slipped away all alone to a prison payphone, and he made this very, very painful, tormenting decision. And this decision would have far-reaching effects throughout the national La Cosa Nostra underworld. The agent reports that he answers the call. He gets will you accept a collect call from the Lewisburg Penitentiary or prison, a correctional institute, from Mr. Angelo Leonardo, and he said yes. Says hello, and on the other end, all he hears is, are you still there? And the agent knew exactly what that meant. He knew that Angelo Leonardo was coming in. The mob boss of the Cleveland family, was going to become a government witness in the Las Vegas skimming trials. Needless to say, that agent was happy, and Bill Owsley was happy, and Gary Hart, and a lot of guys I know were happy, because this guy could really sock it to him. He could really put him in the bags, so to speak.
Well, I mean, when you bring somebody like that in, you know, like he called in this case, and then they go, you know, are you still there? Angelo, Big Ange,
right,
they'd take him out of the prison that he's in and take him, I don't know, to somewhere they could debrief him, you would think, because they've got probably a long laundry list of questions that they would want to ask and cross-reference to maybe other material that they had to see if he was telling the truth or he's just leading him along on a wild goose chase.
Yeah, great question there. That's exactly what here's what happens is he says he'll come in. It was kind of interesting that, are you still there? He quietly asked. That's like this guy, his whole life, he had talked like that. He had talked as if you already know what he's talking about. You don't have to say it directly. That's why those mob guys talk. You've listened to those wiretaps. You'll know they talk in half sentences, and the other person on the other end has to know kind of what you're talking about, or they're not going to figure it out. Well, this agent knew that the last time he had been there, he had asked him if he would come in and testify, and they'd offer him a deal. He'd help him out. And when Angelo Leonardo says, "Are you still there?" that's all he needs to say. What happens when you become a government witness like that, and especially a guy at this level, they, first of all, they'll put him in segregation or protective custody immediately, unless he doesn't want to. He thinks that you can keep it quiet because he doesn't want to alert anybody. You never know. You kind of have to work with the person who's coming in. Either way, pretty soon they have to do some court action. They have to get into court without calling in the opposing attorney. And it's pretty hard to get anything into court without calling in the opposing attorney. But you've got to get something going to get you a court order to then move him, or maybe they can get the probation and parole people or the prison system to at least, first of all, you probably get the prison system to move him to maybe a county jail. Like a rural county jail is a good place to move a guy like this, and they do that quite often. Here in Kansas City, they might move you up to Clinton County, where I'm from, that has a halfway decent jail and is reasonably secure, or maybe on farther north up to St. Joe or over into Kirksville or someplace like that, someplace within driving distance of where you want to go talk to him, basically.
It's convenient.
It's convenient, right.
not like a large population in prison.
Yeah, that's where it starts. I started talking about court appearances and court actions. Now, first, they start with moving people, getting the prison system to move them out to a county jail. They have that in their ability.
Even though he's in the federal prison system.
Federal prison system, but they can store him anywhere they want.
As long as they track him. Where did Big Ange, you know, what's the background there? Where did he come up from?
He was born into it. His father, Joseph Leonardo, was the mob boss in Cleveland during the Prohibition times in the 1930s. He would have been hooked up with Al Capone, really close with Al Capone. His father was killed by a man named Salvatore Todaro. Angelo Leonardo then killed Salvatore Todaro in retaliation, and he was able to stand up against police questioning. He was able to stand up against the other mob people because he did this without approval. The New York mob, the Genovese family, actually kind of oversaw the Cleveland family at this point in time. And in later years, he had to get, since he didn't have permission to do that, he had to go to New York and get himself cleared on killing Todaro. And he got that done. And it kind of paved his way to, he made his bones in this way. I think maybe other people didn't really care if Todaro got killed, and which helps you become a made guy. And during the 1930s, I think we talked about this before, yeah, Albert Anastasia, people were selling mob memberships for maybe as much as $50,000. And the commission, which is the heads of the five families in New York and the head of the family in Chicago and maybe Santos Traficante out of Florida might come up for a commission meeting. The commission had said they're closing the books. That's a term they use, Aaron. When they don't take any new members, they close the books.
Well, it doesn't mean much, does it, in the mafia or La Cosa Nostra world if you're buying membership?
It doesn't mean anything. And people were doing that. But they finally opened them back up by the end of World War II. And Angelo Leonardo was a made member in 1940s, sometime in the early 1940s. He had an initiation ceremony in a Statler hotel room. Now, I told you, if you remember, Aaron, that he came in and he started talking. So he gave a detailed description of becoming a made member of the Cleveland La Cosa Nostra family. I want to read that word for word in his own words. You know, we like to say from the mouths of the men who did it, or who were involved in it at least, and this is definitely from Angelo Leonardo's mouth. He said, I was invited into a room at the Statler Hotel in Cleveland. I was asked if I knew what I was doing there. I was naturally supposed to say no. At the time, present were John Scalise, who was the acting boss, Tony Milano, who was the underboss, a capo named John DeMarco, and another mob member named Frank Brancato. They explained to me that I've been proposed to be made a member of La Cosa Nostra, and they defined the rules and regulations of the organization. They told me that I cannot fool around with narcotics, I cannot own a house of prostitution or have prostitutes working for me, I can't fool around with another woman who's married to a member of La Cosa Nostra. I guess it's okay to fool around with a woman who isn't, who's married but not a member, married to a member of La Cosa Nostra.
Not a maid member.
Right. And whatever illegal activity that I engage in, I have to report it to the boss and receive permission to engage in that activity. After I was told the rules, I was asked if I still wanted to join the organization. One can still leave at that time, but the person usually accepts. In my case, I joined and became a member of La Cosa Nostra. Once I accepted the rules of membership, they lifted a cloth off a table. Underneath it was a gun and a dagger. I was told that I now live and die with the dagger and the gun. I was told I die that way and I live that way. Then I was given a card with a picture of a saint on it. This card was placed in the palm of my hand and lit on fire. I shook the burning card back and forth until it burned down to ashes. Then one of the other men, I can't remember which, pinched my finger to draw blood. Then everybody gave me a kiss on the cheek and said, "You're now a member." I later learned that to be invited a member, I must have killed somebody and been able to stand up to police pressure. So if you remember, he killed this Salvatore Todaro, who killed his father, and he had to stand up against police pressure. He was actually arrested and convicted of that and then got an appeal and then got found not guilty in his second trial and never gave up anything. So they knew he was a man. They knew he'd keep his mouth shut and was willing to do the time. Mentioned John Scalise, and he was the acting boss at that time. He became the boss in 1949, right after our friend Angelo Leonardo was made a member. And Scalise was kind of, he was careful. He refused to make any new members. He refused most, I think, almost his whole career as my boss, which was in the double digits years, we'll find out in a minute. He never wanted to make any new members. Big Ange would live the life of a made guy in Cleveland, overseeing loan sharking and illegal gambling interests and all kinds of other mob activities. And what's kind of interesting, there's a lot of other things that happened, but for this purposes of this podcast, I want to talk about the 1970s and the whole skimming operation. Now, we talked with our friend Bill Friedman from Las Vegas, or from the Nevada, Las Vegas area, Las Vegas, Nevada area, and he's a real expert, and he talked about how the early people who ran illegal casinos, like Mo Dalitz, Maurice Kleinman, were the ones that the mob then tapped to run the first, and the gaming commission in Nevada tapped to run the first casinos, because these guys knew how to run a casino and knew how to make money with it. Well, Scalise and the Cleveland family partnered up with Mo Dalitz and Maurice Kleinman and some other Jewish gamblers, and they had been running illegal casinos down in Kentucky. These Jewish gamblers bought into the Desert Inn, and the Cleveland family provided protection from other mobsters for a piece of the action. They also provided probably some Teamsters money to help Mo Dalitz and Maurice Kleinman buy the Desert Inn. Later, Mo Dalitz would buy into the Stardust with Teamster money, and early on, it was only Chicago and Cleveland that shared the profits from that casino. Kind of like the New York mob joined with Mayor Lansky. If you remember, another Jewish gangsters have formed the National Crime Syndicate. Remember Bill Friedman talked about that, how Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello did not maintain a strict Italian connection, or strict Italian connections to do their illegal gambling and do their other illegal activities, they joined in and formed the National Crime Syndicate with other Jewish gangsters. And that's what they were doing in Cleveland with Mo Dalitz. John Scalise had also taken in Angelo Leonardo's brother-in-law, a Jewish gangster named Milton Mashy Rockman. They called him Mashy, and I don't know the derivation of that nickname. Took him in as a trusted advisor, and some people started calling him Cleveland, the Cleveland mob's treasurer. He handled their money. He did all their money things. Rockman would eventually become the conduit through which the Las Vegas casino scheme would pass to the Italian gangsters. Of course, he kept a little piece of it. He also formed a relationship with the Cleveland Teamsters Union official named Jackie Presser and would maintain that liaison, which would become important in how they got Teamsters pension fund money to loan to buy casinos with.
Right? I remember we had talked a little bit about the Teamsters Union, and the name Jackie Presser had come up before in another episode.
Right, and he actually, Jackie Presser was doing a double duty there. He was a Cleveland mob. He was owned by the Cleveland mob. He's also a top echelon informant for the FBI. John Scalise will die of natural causes in 1976. Leonardo claimed that Mashy Rockman called him into a meeting and after Scalise died and said that Scalise requested a guy named Jack Lecavoli, who was a former Detroit mobster, be named the new boss, which started a mob war in Cleveland. There was another mobster named John Nardi who thought he should be the boss. Lecavoli names Leonardo as his underboss, so our boy Big Ange is moving up. He's now moved up to underboss by 1976. At that point in time, Leonardo told the FBI that Mashy Rockman told him the details of the Las Vegas skimming operation, and Big Ange was pleasantly surprised to learn that he would start receiving a large amount of skim cash with his new position as underboss. But during this time, in the later 70s, they've got the casino skim coming in. Got their other rackets going. There was an Irish gangster in Cleveland named Danny Green. Danny Green had, as a young man, had become a longshoreman. They've got a big dock operation there on the, Lake Erie at Cleveland. He had moved he became a longshoreman and he was in the union. He moved on up in the union, and he started embezzling union money and taking payoffs from shipping companies. And this he didn't share with the Cleveland mob. Now, the Cleveland mob family does not like these kinds of activities going on that they don't control and don't get a piece of the action. Later on, as he expanded his criminal enterprise, Green did, and he always bucked up against these Italian mob guys. He organized several private waste hauling companies, and he started extorting money from these companies, telling them that, you know, they either paid him or he would start getting their routes taken away from them. And he controlled all the routes and who got what route and for that activity and protection from other mobsters, they had to pay him off. He also started trying to move in and take over on some vending machine routes that were connected to the Italian and Jewish-dominated mob. This ended up resulting in a violent mob war between the La Cosa Nostra in Cleveland and the Danny Green gang. And, you know, you remember me saying John Nardi, he was a Cleveland mob guy, and he was pissed off that Scalise was, that Jack Lecavoli was named the new boss, and he felt like he should have been. Well, he joined in with Danny Green and conspired with him to start trying to kill off Angelo Leonardo, Jack Lecavoli, and other Cleveland La Cosa Nostra mob guys. They found out about it, and the Cleveland mob, probably Angelo Leonardo, had something to do with this, set a car bomb in his car in the parking lot of a Teamsters Hall in Cleveland, and John Nardi was killed. Then they went after Danny Green. They had 8 failed attempts to kill Green. If you saw the movie Kill the Irishman or saw the documentary, which To Kill the Irishman, it's on YouTube. I think you can see the whole thing. And then there was a narrative movie out there.
It's a good movie. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it. I saw it when it first came out. I knew about it. I'd read the book. This policeman in Rick Perello, who's a cop in Cleveland, he had written another book.
That wasn't Kill the Irishman.
There was I had read the book To Kill the Irishman, and I kind of studied it, looked up on who wrote it, and there's a cop at one time. He was now a former cop. I don't know if he was retired like I did or he just quit to start writing books. He had began his writing career because he was curious about the mysterious murder of his grandfather and several of his uncles. He started writing The Rise and Fall of the Cleveland Mafia, which is basically a biography of Leonardo. And Perello went on to write a second book, To Kill the Irishman, The War That Crippled the Mafia, and that recounted the story of Danny Green and his war with the Cleveland Mafia. A real well-received book. And like I said, there's a free documentary on YouTube, and then there's a To Kill the Irishman is a narrative movie, which I would recommend highly.
Well, after eight failed attempts to kill Danny Green, they end up killing him. You can find this out. There's actually a Wikipedia page for the Cleveland mob and the Cleveland family. And it basically talks about while Green was inside the building for a dental appointment, Ferredo and Ronald the Crab
Carabia
planted a box bomb inside a bomb car. And while Green was inside the dentist, they parked the car next to Green's. When Green came out and went to open his door, Carabia set off the bomb, killing Green instantly.
You know, That's interesting. That's I remember one time the mafia was trying in Sicily. The mafia in Sicily was trying to kill a prosecutor, and he was always surrounded with soldiers. And what they did is they parked a car along a road that they knew this prosecutor was going to drive by with his escort. Just they had a remote control device, and just as the prosecutor got next to the bomb car, the car with the bomb, they set it off. They did the same thing to Danny Green. He was pretty suspicious by this time. We've never had that in Kansas City. It's a little bit more sophisticated. It's also, you got it, you're taking a chance of taking out innocent parties too, and you ought to be in a line of sight so you can make sure there's no little kids walking by the car when you set that thing off. If you ever go to Cleveland, where all this happened was a place called Brainerd Place, and it still stands today. If you exit Interstate 271 on exit 32, you'll be able to see it. So if we had a mob tour app in Cleveland, we would have to put that one on.
You would have to add that to the Kansas City Mob Tour app.
Really? Well, in the aftermath of this conflict, Danny Green's gone, and his little organization is scattered here and there, and the Cleveland mob feels pretty secure. The government's after him at this point in time, and Jack Licavoli was convicted of a variety of crimes, and he was also, they investigated the murder of Danny Green, and they ended up getting one of the killers in this, the Ferredo, what was his name? It was Ronald, not Carabia. Well, anyhow, his name was Ferredo. I don't see it right offhand. He ended up making a deal. He heard that the mob was going to have him killed in order to keep him from ever testifying. So he beat him to the punch, and he came on in and started testifying against his boss, Jack Licavoli, who then was sent to prison for the murder of Danny Green. This was 1982. Angelo Leonardo, whose dad was the Prohibition-era mob boss, Joseph Leonardo, then took control of the Cleveland crime family as the boss, and he would lead the crime family, the Cleveland family, until 1984. when he, as I mentioned before, he was convicted of running a drug ring and sentenced to life in prison for his part in that, which that's when he became the informant, making him the highest-ranking mafia turncoat at that time.
Shortly. So it was Rain as the Cleveland mob boss. Pretty short, 2 years, really.
Really, yeah. He didn't last very long. But he would later, shortly after he came in, he would confirm everything. They had all these wiretaps going in the straw man case, which was the code name for the case that started in Kansas City, and they put up wires all over Kansas City and Chicago and Milwaukee and Cleveland and Las Vegas to investigate these skimming of funds from mainly the Stardust but also the Tropicana Casino. And he would confirm everything that Massey Rockman had told him about that and that the wiretaps had said. And it probably, he had to end up testifying against his brother-in-law, Massey Rockman, which would have been particularly hard. But I think, you know, Aaron, let's go ahead and we're up around 30 minutes or maybe a little more. Let's go ahead and close this one down.
Before we close it out, didn't you have a little sound bite, a little audio clip?
I thought maybe we'd start the next one with that.
With that? Okay. Yeah. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, then definitely stay tuned for the next episode when we talk about Big Ange, Angelo Leonardo.
Let me give my public service announcement. I have long supported the nonprofit First Call. If you have a friend, relative, child, grandchild, spouse, parent, or anyone you care about that has an addiction problem, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. It's a 24-hour-a-day hotline that you can call anytime. If you're outside the area and you just want local resources in your area, you might go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org, or just call that number and ask them for some contacts in your area.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own personal tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City from the convenience of your own car. And, of course, check out the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, the true story of a turf war in the city market over parking that ended to get the FBI involved and wiretapped the local La Cosa Nostra to get in the middle of a conversation about skimming in Las Vegas.
And one more thing, Aaron, I want to do a big shout-out and a big thank you to Benjamin Ellickson. He made a nice little donation on the he put a hit out on the donate button. I have sent him some links to some things and other things, so we will just remember, if you put a hit out on our donate button, we'll do something for you.
That's right. We'll give you exclusive audio that nobody else has. If you're outside the U.S., that's the easiest thing, is to give them a digital perk. If they're inside the U.S., you may get a signed autographed copy of Gangland Wire, the documentary.
Yeah, if you want that, I'll get hold of Benjamin, see what he wants. I sent him some links, but I need to get hold. Benjamin, I'll get hold of you and see if there's something else that we can actually send you.
And check out Gary Jenkins' other great documentaries, including Negroes to Hire, Slave Life and Culture in an Antebellum Missouri Farms, as well as Freedom Seekers, Stories from the Western Underground Railroad.
I made those two for educational purposes, and I made this one more for fun. This is more entertaining, I think, than those two. But anyhow, so I digress. Let's go ahead and get out of here, Aaron. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.